It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a teacher makes the case that freedom of the press should extend to high school publications.
First, it's been nearly 8 years since the United States plunged into the Great Recession. The collapse of the auto industry and the housing market sent the country's economy into a tailspin. Of course, since then, the economy has been rebounding and job growth has been moderate but steady.
However, a new report shows that while many parts of the country are bouncing back, a lot of other areas, including major urban centers like Milwaukee, are still struggling. Joining us now to talk about these disparities is Steve Glickman. He's co-founder of the Economic Innovation Group, a nonpartisan organization based in Washington that authored this report. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about the report. What were you trying to accomplish? What were you measuring here?
So we were measuring community well-being across the country. We looked at a number of criteria for just about every zip code across the country. It included education, housing, the rate of adults not working, the poverty rate, income, employment, and the rate of change in businesses. And we used that to heat map, essentially, the whole country and determine what communities and zip codes were the most prosperous and those that were the most distressed. And what we found was pretty surprising.
What did you find? Where were these hotspots?
Well, I think the headline for us is that the communities that were really prosperous, and those are cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles, cities like Washington, D.C., and Austin and Denver, have experienced a boom in the 5 years since the recession. They're recovering at remarkable levels. On the other hand, when you look at distressed areas, and most of these areas on a city level were in the kind of Rust Belt Midwest, the top most distressed areas were Cleveland, Detroit, Newark, and then number seven in the country was Milwaukee. Their reality is entirely different. They experienced almost no recovery during the recession. In fact, many of these cities, including Milwaukee, lost jobs and lost businesses over the course of the last 5 years. And so we're experiencing two different economic realities in this country, where there are certain cities that have been benefiting from the recovery and certain cities that have just gotten a lot worse.
Right. You could go to, and you break it down by zip code, you could go to a lot of zip codes in the rural South and in the urban Rust Belt and be correct in saying, hey, the recovery just never happened here, right?
That's exactly right. And it's a good point on the South, where we see the most distress on a state level. It's almost all southern states, led off by a state like Mississippi, where you see 40% of the people in Mississippi lived in a distressed area. You compare that to Wisconsin overall as a state, and it did actually quite well. Only 8% of the residents lived in a distressed community. But when you go to the city level in Milwaukee, you have over 50% of the population is living in a distressed community. And Milwaukee is carrying a lot of the distress for the entire state of Wisconsin.
And again, breaking it down zip code by zip code, there are places where, if you're over in this zip code, you're in good shape. If you're a few miles away in another one, you might be in really bad shape. We keep hearing about economic disparities, income disparities. We're seeing what you call a spatial disparity in a lot of places.
Yeah, that's right. Let me give you a little snapshot of what a really prosperous zip code and community and what a really distressed zip code and community feel like. In a really prosperous zip code, only like 5% of the population doesn't have a high school degree. In a distressed area, you're talking about 25% of the population doesn't have a high school degree. In a really distressed area, the poverty rate is like 30%. When in a prosperous community, it's 5%. And as we talked about a little earlier, in a distressed zip code, you see losses of jobs and businesses in a high single and low double digits. In the prosperous community, they gained 10 to 20% businesses and jobs. So it's two entirely different realities. And as you noted, when we looked at spatial inequality, we looked at to the degree that neighboring zip codes and neighboring communities were facing in these incredible economic differences. Milwaukee does all right as a city because there's so much distress throughout the city. But when you bring it out to a metropolitan area, Milwaukee is the fifth most most unequal metropolitan area in the country. So the suburbs don't bear any resemblance to what the city of Milwaukee looks like economically.
So that's interesting, because Milwaukee is known as one of the most racially segregated areas in the country. It sounds like you're saying the economic segregation, the disparity there is almost as striking.
That's right, and the two may be connected. We didn't look at demographics in this study, but what we find in a lot of communities is there's a pretty strong correlation between demographics and economic outcome in our analysis. The other, I think, really striking thing about both Wisconsin and Milwaukee is the rate of entrepreneurship. So the Kauffman Foundation has looked at this and found Wisconsin comes dead last in terms of states and entrepreneurial activity. And our data supports that, including for Milwaukee. Milwaukee does pretty poorly in connection with other cities around the country. And we saw that Milwaukee lost 3% of its businesses over the last 5 years. And that's a huge problem, because without those new businesses, it's really difficult to create new jobs and high-wage jobs. And if you look at the median income in Milwaukee compared to the rest of the state, people in Milwaukee on average are only earning about two-thirds of the income that other folks around the state of Wisconsin are earning.
Talking to Steve Glickman from the Economic Innovation Group about a new report with graphics demonstrating income disparity, economic opportunity, I should say, disparities around the country, at local levels, at state levels. So, Steve, we've got this information now, these very striking graphics that you can look at the national level, at a state level. You can drill down to zip code to zip code. What are you hoping that people, policymakers, maybe do with this information, with these charts?
Well, I think our biggest focus and one of the areas that bind a lot of the most distressed areas relates to investment and access to capital. We're at a sort of stage in the economic recovery of the U.S. where we need some kind of radical change in how we think about the way we drive investment and businesses to cities and communities that haven't recovered along with the rest of the country. There has long been a history, and this is kind of the silver lining, of bipartisan cooperation around these type of geographic incentives that provide certain types of benefits for investors to move investments and businesses into communities that have fallen behind in order to stimulate job growth and business growth locally. And if you don't do something like that, it's really hard to recover, because we're seeing the communities like Milwaukee in this downward spiral where they start to lose businesses, and those obviously take jobs with them. That takes away the tax base for the local city to be able to fund big infrastructure projects, which make that city less competitive for new investment. So unless you step in and do something different where you create a new attraction for the private sector to come in and invest, there's a real threat that Milwaukee will continue to do worse and worse every year.
But I wonder, if we're looking at these economically distressed areas, if we're talking about a Rust Belt city like Milwaukee or those rural areas in the deep south, lack of financial economic resources can sometimes translate into a lack of political influence, of political capital to advocate for those kind of things you're talking about. So what would it take to get that kind of targeted support for these areas?
Well, the good news is there are already a group of members of Congress working on it. It's a bipartisan group led by Wisconsin a native and Ron Kind. He, along with Pat Tiberi from Ohio and Senators Tim Scott from South Carolina and Cory Booker in New Jersey, have formed a working group in Congress to look at this very issue, to find new ways and formulas to create the type of incentives that will get investors to pay attention to communities like Milwaukee and elsewhere in the Midwest, and as you noted, the rural parts of the South. There's some hope. And on top of that, you see both Speaker Paul Ryan making poverty a huge priority for his new leadership in Congress, and reaching out to the Congressional Black Caucus to try to find some new solutions, as well as President Obama offering his take on promise zones and the need to focus geographically on the parts of the country that have recovered the least. So there is some nascent energy in that space. We'd like to see more members and certainly the presidential candidates focus on this issue as well.
So that's your hope for help for these economically troubled, distressed areas around the country. What's your fear, I guess? What are the consequences of inaction as you see it?
Well, I mean, there's several, and I'll tell you what the most scary one is for us. There's been some more and more recent research that have tied where you grow up to where you'll end up in life. So that being poor in certain communities, like let's take Seattle or San Francisco, is a lot different than being poor in a Milwaukee or Detroit. Your chances of getting out of poverty, of moving from the bottom 20% socioeconomically to the top 20% in a Seattle or San Francisco, is something close to 10 to 15%. In these rural city, in these Rust Belt cities in the Midwest, the numbers are a lot closer to zero. And so what's happening is the American dream is being limited to those who happen to grow up in the right part of the country. They happen to be born in the right zip code, and that's just not what, you know, the American values are all about. And we're really not just sacrificing the future for children across the country, but even more so, it's leading to a huge amount of political uncertainty and chaos in this country, where you see you see populism being much more attractive for candidates being found outside the mainstream, and that's creating some real, I think, political challenges for the country right now.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Steve Glickman. He's co-founder of the Economic Innovation Group, which just released a report on economically distressed areas of the United States.
Coming up, we talked to a high school teacher about the importance of press freedoms for school newspapers.
A couple years ago, the student magazine at Fond du Lac High School published an article about sexual assault. In response, the school administration came up with a policy that would allow them to effectively censor future stories.
As a result, the magazine's faculty advisor recently joined a movement in Wisconsin to promote press freedom for student journalists. And Matthew Smith joins us now. He's a teacher at Fond du Lac High School and a member of the New Voices movement in Wisconsin. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Matthew, can you take us back to that original story that brought about this issue of press freedom for students? What was it about? What happened?
It was titled The Rape Joke. And I think the impetus was that the student reporters felt that rape was being used as a joke, as sort of a laugh line in the school. And we wanted to shed light on the fact that we have students at the school, it's a large school, who have experienced sexual assault, for whom hearing jokes like that was horrific, and just wanted to make it clear that this is, sexual assault is a real problem throughout the country, and that the culture everywhere, not just at our school, but sort of everywhere in the country, maybe took that a little too flippantly. It didn't take it seriously enough, the harm that you could cause by joking around about things that were that serious.
So the piece was critical of the school, and not just the school, but the cultural response. Is that right?
Yeah, and it wasn't really critical of the school so much as it included some students being very frank about their experiences, and that they were anonymous sources, they were protected, but you know, it did include some frank language, and it was very upfront about what these experiences were like and how these students feel when they see it taken lightly.
And what was the response from the school administration?
I mean, overall, it had a great response in the school. I know it was read by just about every student, I think, and I think it was being used in some classes for class discussions. It was a month afterward or so that we received new guidelines from the school district saying, I was told that there was an understanding as to why we did that story, that they wanted new policy would mean that the principal needed to review from now on and approve all future stories. So it came about a month afterward.
Were there specific objections?
That always kind of went back and forth for that story. I think objections included some of the artwork, which was a female student just holding up a sheet of paper that where they had kind of written on the title and some stats they had gotten. There was objection to some of the language, to a few things. I never had a clear picture of exactly what about that story was specifically objectionable, just that it was made very clear to me right away that from now on they wanted to review and approve.
As an advisor, did you have any hesitations, any red flags go up for you when you were contemplating publishing this piece?
I mean, it was a very sensitive topic. And I think, I mean, what's so great about the way we operate now, the way we operated then, and the way that we're pushing for new voices is students need to learn that they are responsible for what they say and need to be given a chance to take that seriously. So when we were doing that story, I know the reporter and some of the editors, there were lots of conversations. I remember there were times when certain sections, certain quotes in the story were highlighted to be seen with question marks written by the students themselves saying, should we say this? Is this okay? What do you think? With different wordings. Went back and forth a lot. I took it very seriously. The students did too. And I think we forget sometimes that not everyone's aware that that's going on. Like how seriously that was taken, how purposefully that story was put together to have the best positive impact for the community.
And Matthew, you're now a member of the New Voices movement in Wisconsin. How did that experience in that Fond du Lac High School catapult you to get involved in the conversation about press freedoms for students?
I think more than anything, I think I was naive before in thinking that everyone understood best practices for journalism education and for journalism, and understood the training that we receive and the way that our professional code of ethics implore us to proceed for best learning. So I think I mostly was shocked. I kind of shaken awake that the fact that a lot of the principals and other school district personnel and other people don't know that what we're doing is best. They don't know all the rigorous work that's going into it. After that, and after seeing my students do everything they could to get that policy reversed, which they did, it woke me up that that could happen again, not just at Fond du Lac maybe, but at any school. There's lots of schools where I think the schools would feel totally empowered to take control of student media and not know the damage that they could be doing to education.
Are there any legal protections for student journalism, especially high school journalists, right now on the books?
There's quite a lot, actually. Primarily the First Amendment, which is that's in the Constitution, and we have lots of court cases upholding that, making it clear that students still have constitutional rights in school. But the problem is what we have to go by, without a state law, without state legislators taking the lead to help clarify things that's for best for student learning. Without that, we have a bunch of court cases that all overlap in different ways, and I think make it hard not just for an advisor and students in the class to know exactly what we're supposed to be doing or allowed to be doing, but certainly for administrators and principals and school district officials, they don't have a background in that. There's no way they're going to study up all about Hazelwood and Tinker and Dean versus Utica and all these other court cases that make it clear that schools are not allowed to censor student speech just because they don't like the message or they disagree with that point of view. That is always protected. With or without a state law, you can't just, a government official in the form of a public school cannot just shut down speech for point of view.
And there was a recent case in North Dakota that got at this. What can you tell us about that particular case?
Yeah, I think, for me, a couple of years ago when stuff happened with our paper, it woke me up to the need for something. But I wasn't sure how to go about it or whether it would be even possible to get a law passed here as they have in several other states already. But last year, North Dakota was able to get such a bill passed unanimously. It had such strong support all across the political spectrum. And I think me watching that and talking to some of the people who were instrumental in that in North Dakota really inspired me, seeing that it can happen. And when you educate people enough and when you get the conversation going, it becomes very clear how much this is a win-win for everyone. Teaching students to know their rights and use their rights and act responsibly and learn to use their voice responsibly, that's really important now since they all have their cell phones on them. They're publishing stuff all day. We need to make sure that they're taking ethics into consideration, that they're trying to do what's best. And they need real practice doing that.
And this was a unanimous thing in North Dakota, and I know New Voices has tried to encourage similar things to happen here in Wisconsin, but it has not been a bipartisan response here that you've seen. It sounds like there's some Democratic support, but what do you want legislators to know about why you think this could be a bipartisan issue?
Because I think students learning their rights and really practicing them and when students try to do the right thing and they're trying to get good messages out, to know that they're going to be able to do that, I think is really powerful. I think here in Fond du Lac, what happened a year and a half or 2 years ago, I think is an amazing example of what you get from a journalism program where students know that they own their own voices. And we operated for years that way without any censorship or review. And I think that you can see in the response to the censorship that students had learned, you know, this is how I respond to something I think that's unjust. I respond in a civil way. I start conversations. I speak up for myself at school board meetings. I write letters to things. I build support, and I get things changed the right way. And I think the fact that our students were able to do that, I think, is the best illustration possible of how great that education was before, how great it was that they were used to owning their own voices and making responsible decisions.
And just very briefly as we wrap up, but what would you say to school district officials who might say that's all great, but I'm the one who's going to have to answer to parents who might be upset with what's being published?
Oh, I totally understand that. I guess I'd mostly say this bill is nothing to, you know, all these new voices laws across in other states do nothing to restrict a school's ability to try to prohibit or punish speech that is truly illegal or harmful. Like, students are not allowed, are not given a free pass, no matter what, to do really harmful things to people, to bully people, to libel or invade privacy or disrupt the school environment. They're not allowed to do that anyway. And this bill is nothing to keep schools from keeping students safe in the building. I think too often, without a law like this to make it sure that schools aren't reviewing and censoring, schools start censoring for the wrong reasons, you know, without even thinking about it.
And Matthew, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Matthew Smith, teacher at Fond du Lac High School and a member of the New Voices movement in Wisconsin.